This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Police say there were 1,600 reported cases of rape in the first three quarters of 2019, almost double compared to that period for each of the previous 2 years.
That's Mokondisi Dube reporting from Habrone. Details coming up also. More than 35,000 Ghanaians are in Libya, according to the International Organization for Migration. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the International Organization for Migration's IOM says more than 35,550 Ghanaians are in Libya, having gone there on their way to Europe, but many now want to return home. Mavis Ocheri in Ghana has more.
There are more than 650,000 illegal migrants in Libya, about 6,000 of them rescued at sea or arrested by Libyan security forces are in crowded detention centers, the International Organization for Migration reports. The migrants, mostly Africans, attempt to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe from Libya. Since May 2017, the IOM has helped more than 1,260 migrants voluntarily return to Ghana and reintegrate into their communities. Kim Florence is the IOM spokesperson for Western Central Africa based in Dakar, Senegal. She says for the past year, the UN agency has seen a dramatic decrease in the number of migrants arriving from West Africa seeking to reach Italy through Libya. IOM data show that this year 11,000 migrants reached Italy through Libya, compared with more than 100,000 a few years ago. Florence says since 2014, more than 200,000 people have died in the Mediterranean Sea trying to reach Europe. This year, just under 800 people died, the lowest number in several years. Florence says despite the falling death toll, the migration flow remains a humanitarian issue that needs all stakeholders to address.
All the awareness raising, all the information that we are trying to spread across West Africa are actually working. We have more and more returned migrants who are actually less ashamed to share their own stories, to share their experience, to talk about the unspeakable abuses they actually faced along their journey. So I think, and we are also trying to involve as much as possible all the traditional leaders, all the local authorities and goodwill ambassadors to actually talk and explain what's going on. So this is also a factor explaining the fact that less and less people are actually leaving Libya to Italy and they rather return home.
Florence says West African governments, the families of migrants, the United Nations aid group and the migrants themselves share the responsibility for addressing illegal migration to Libya. Even the news media have a role, she says, by reporting the stories of returnees. She called for governments in West Africa with support from UN agencies to put the right structures in place so that the youth can hope in their future in their home countries. She called for governments in West Africa with support from UN agencies to put the right structures in place so that the youth can hope in their future in their countries.
The governments are seeing their youth leaving. But the youth is actually the future of the economies, of the development of these countries. So it's for the benefit of all that we make sure that these youth, these African youth, the West African youth, Ghanaian youth, is actually aware of the local opportunities at home. And if they don't want to stay, actually that they are aware of the legal pathways to migrate.
Florence says IOM programs are reaching about 200,000 people in Ghana. Some programs help returning migrants migrants reintegrate and others work to reduce illegal migration to the barest minimum. She also encourages societies to stop stigmatizing returned migrants. Instead, they should be listened to because the returnees can help keep people from taking dangerous illegal migration routes. Reporting for VOA, this is Mary Sotre in Ghana.
Police in Botswana say reported incidents of rape have nearly doubled in the past year. Activists say successful anti-rape campaigns have made victims more confident about reporting when they are attacked. But the higher recorded levels of rape also have spurred activists in Botswana to demand more action against sexual assault, as Mokandisi Dube reports from Habrone.
32-year-old Mpho Modise, not her real name, was attacked and raped by two men while walking home earlier this year.
Even now, the thing is still on me. Sometimes I try to forget about it, but by the time it comes to my mind, I feel the pain. I tried to look for people to counsel me, but still, the pain is still on me.
Police say there were 1,600 reported cases of rape in the first three quarters of 2019, almost double compared to that period for each of the previous 2 years. Activists like Desmond Lunga of Men and Boys for Gender Equality say the increase is due to victims feeling more comfortable about reporting attacks due to increased campaigning against rape.
And the first thing that we have been doing as activists is, one, to encourage people to report. So there's been a lot of rape that has been happening, but people have not been reporting. So one, as we see the numbers increasing, sometimes it's also a light to say people are seeing this and are able to go and report.
Despite this trend, social worker Komotso Jongmen says rape remains difficult to deal with due to the fact that in most cases the perpetrator is known to the victim.
Majority of the people who were raped by the family members or people closer to the family or the people that they know. That is something that I found very strange and very disturbing.
Lorato Mwalusi of the Botswana Gender-Based Violence Prevention and Support Center says more research is needed on the causes behind the widespread sexual assaults.
The scourge of rape, it's very high. Botswana has done very well in terms of trying to control HIV. But if we are not going to try and control the sexual violence, we are going to lose all the gains that we made. The silence must be broken. The silence is too loud.
Botswana's vulnerable are hoping that more accurate rape statistics will spur the nation to take more action. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni.
Militants who say they are associated with the Islamic State have released a video that appears to show the execution of 11 Christians in northeast Nigeria. The footage was posted online late yesterday. It showed 11 blindfolded men being shot and stabbed. According to the French news agency, one of the killers said it was a message to Christians all over the world. He also said it was in retaliation for the death of Islamic State chief Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. News organizations could not verify the authenticity of the video. Baghdadi committed suicide in October as U.S. Special Force troops raided his hideout in Syria's Idlib province. The Islamic State West African Province group has launched several attacks on civilians and security personnel in northeast Nigeria. The region is home to the Boko Haram militant groups that have waged an insurgency for nearly a decade. Thousands of people have died in attacks and 10,000 have been displaced. After more than a decade of rapidly expanding their investment in African nations, Chinese businesses and officials are showing signs of slowing the pace of growth. Some are making noise about corruption and stalling on some projects. Today in our series on China's role in Africa, Darren Taylor in Johannesburg looks at this hesitation.
In South Africa, nearly 30% of workers are unemployed, and the rand is down more than 30% from a year ago. The almost total collapse of the state energy provider, Eskom, is a big contributor to the economic weakness. China lent Eskom $2.5 billion last year, but the country's ambassador to Pretoria, Lin Songqian, has referred to the utility as a debt trap. David Lewis, an economist and the director of South Africa's Corruption Watch nonprofit, says Lin's comments are highly significant.
In the case of the Chinese, it's rendered all the more significant by the fact that state-owned Chinese companies have not been absent in the state capture story in South Africa.
Government critics say under former President Jacob Zuma, some individuals and corporate interests encouraged state policies that allowed them to milk the profits from state-owned businesses, a practice known as state capture. In Kenya, Chinese business interests indicate they have doubts about the new Standard Gauge Railway, or SGR, intended to link the port of Mombasa with Uganda. Two sections linking Mombasa to the town of Naivasha, northwest of Nairobi, are finished with Chinese funding. But China won't lend Kenya the almost $4 billion it needs to build the final track to the Ugandan border. Kenyan economist Anzetse Were has been following the SGR saga closely.
That third phase has been put on hold because of, I think, a lack of alignment between what the Kenya government wanted and what the Chinese government was willing to finance.
She says a major concern is the SGR's high cost, more than $5.5 million per kilometre of track. That's almost three times the international standard and four times the original estimate. Chinese officials and Kenya's railway operator did not respond to requests for interviews on the matter. But Kenyan officials have said its loans from China will be worth it when the SGR is completed, as it will spark economic development. Given concerns that the railway is overpriced, Were says it's not surprising that China has decided not to fund the final phase. For now, instead of building the new railway from Naivasha to Uganda, Kenyan officials say they'll upgrade the existing older line. Were thinks Kenya's leaders must be held responsible for the project's delays because they borrowed too much without a detailed, transparent repayment plan.
It is absolutely, in my view, unacceptable that a government can get into such significant debt and the general public has no idea what's going on. That, to me, is not a problem of the Chinese government. The Chinese government is not accountable to the Kenyan people. It is the Kenyan government that is accountable to the Kenyan people.
Examples such as the Kenyan Railway and South Africa's Eskom have some Chinese business people saying Africa is becoming less attractive. A leading Chinese businessman in Johannesburg, who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity, says Beijing's officials in South Africa are concerned that the government doesn't seem to have a structured plan to revive the economy. As a result, some Chinese business people are leaving South Africa, says banker Erwin Pon, also head of the Johannesburg Chinese Association.
The key thing is what return they can get and the cost associated around that. And I've seen them go wherever the opportunities really are. And I see a lot of them actually going to Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia is the area that's really developing, low cost, etc. So
he says a lot of Chinese have returned to their homeland or moved to Australia, the United States and Britain, where they expect to find better opportunities in established markets. Some are looking at other parts of Africa for investment. China remains South Africa's largest trade and investment partner. Beijing loaned African governments and businesses more than $30 billion last year. As the Chinese Business Insider says, if Beijing turns off its cash tap, South Africa's economy will no longer be in big trouble. Instead, it will implode. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, national and international health experts have battled an outbreak of Ebola for nearly 18 months. This year, new vaccines and new treatments for those infected have saved countless of lives. But violence from regional militias has forced many health workers to leave the region after several were killed or injured in attacks on health facilities. Dr. Michelle Yao leads the World Health Organization's Ebola team in the DRC. He recently spoke with my colleague Kate Bond-Dawson about the gains and reverses seen this year.
Actually, based on lessons learned, the West African outbreak, it was agreed that some of the research that can be technically sound and as well as ethically clear could be conducted. So in this outbreak, while responding at the middle of the response, we were also undertaking some research. So the first one is a vaccine that was used, we call it a compassionate use of vaccine. And actually this vaccine was the results so far show that the vaccine is quite effective. It's actually one of the most effective, and it's helped us actually to contain the disease within the province and to reduce contamination of neighboring countries. So it's actually one of the big achievements. The second innovation is we were using investigational Ebola treatment drugs. At the beginning, we were using four, but from the results we had, the two of them have been shown quite effective.
Now, you've had these very good scientific and medical gains, but the security situation there in DRC is complicating the effort. Can you talk about the problem there?
Actually, we were quite close to the control of this outbreak. In November, we were having less than 10 cases a week. If we compare to what we had earlier in the first quarter of the month, where we reached 100 cases per week. So there was a lot of achievement. But unfortunately, we saw the violence, we cannot operate in the actual what we call hotspot, where we still have active transmission on cases. Because it's really unacceptable that people trying to save others give their life. We are trying to resume because we cannot afford to totally stop the response. We have relocated some of our staff, and we are trying to work remotely with local staff, trying to coach them, and we are also strengthening security measures, at least to increase access.
In the coming year, what is going to be needed to fully contain this outbreak, to bring it to a halt?
So the main thing, critical thing that needs to be done is to secure all this area for the Ebola team to be able to work, and we may not be far from controlling this outbreak. So if access can be granted, I think we have enough resources, enough knowledge, enough capacity on the ground to deal with this outbreak.
That was Dr. Michelle Yao with the WHO in Goma, DRC. He spoke with VOA's Kate Bond-Dawson. Residents and government officials say another oil spill in South Sudan's former unity state is causing serious environmental pollution in the area. The residents are concerned about oil companies' failure to detect oil spills when they happen and their inability to put out fires suspected of being started by charcoal makers. Dimo Silva Aurielu reports from Juba.
Residents say an oil spill at Kaloi, located about 10 kilometers west of Unity Oil Field, owned and operated by the Chinese Greater Pioneer Operating Company, caught fire last Saturday and continued burning for 2 days, sending thick plumes of smoke into the air. The fire could have accidentally started by local charcoal makers. To make charcoal, residents cut down trees, pile them in a heap, then cover the pile with grass and soil, then set it on fire. After burning for 4 to 5 days, the burnt wood turns into charcoal. Kaloi resident Kai Pan suspects locals' torch of the fire. Speaking in Arabic, he describes what happened.
The fire started at 2 p.m. We saw that it started where people were cutting trees for burning charcoal, and it started going toward the oil pipeline, which is just 10 kilometers from Bintiu oil camp.
Pan says after the fire broke out, cases of airborne diseases suspected of being caused by dangerous oil fumes were reported in the area.
People are now coughing, a lot of coughing in this area, and also there are some skin problems and also eyes pain among residents of this area.
Pan says oil spills are still in the surrounding areas of Kaloi, posing a threat to the community. Dr. Duol Bim, Director General at the Northern Liechi State Health Ministry, says oil companies operating in South Sudan do not follow international safety procedures to handle oil spills in South Sudan.
They don't have fire trucks, they don't have fire extinguishers, they have nothing, okay? They went there and they could not do anything to make sure that the fire is contained, okay? It was just left like that. It was just left like that. It continued burning for 2 days.
Bim says the Chinese company, Jipok, not only failed to contain the fire, but did not detect the leakage until several days later.
Here, in this case, there is negligence on the side of the oil company that is in the area. Because if leakages are happening and they are not being detected on time, this shows that the oil company in the area is not doing a good job, okay? Because it is their responsibility to ensure that leakages are detected on time, they are reported on time and contained on time.
Bim says while a previous oil leak in the Budang area of former Unity State was detected by a soldier who was hunting for wild fruits, this spill was only detected after the oil caught fire. He says oil exploration companies should educate local residents about the dangers of charcoal making near oil manufacturing so that they don't start fires near such facilities.
They are not aware. Okay, these are people who are doing their normal activities. Accidentally, I think it caught, the crude oil caught fire. It is not something intentional, okay? This is something dangerous. Even the locals, they know crude oil is very dangerous when it catches fire. They know this.
South Sudan Petroleum Minister Awoh Daniel Chuang was not available for comment. His phone was switched off. In November, Chuang warned that more oil spills were likely to happen given that pipelines used to transport South Sudanese crude are old and could have rusted. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Stand up!